terrifying days into Taliban rule of Afghanistan, U.S. planes have flown out almost 40,000 people with no end in sight. No end to the people, that is, the would-be evacuees. The mission ends officially 8 days from now, unless it is pushed back. And guess what? The Taliban is pushing back on that. Tonight, though, one success story. A success story very close to my own heart. One I have hinted at, alluded at to, and now I can tell you about in all of its breathtaking detail for the very first time, including a covert rescue operation at dawn, arranged by my team, my digital Dunkirk crew. You'll meet them. And then, new information in that story that rocked South Carolina and the entire nation, the Murdoch family case. A young passenger in the boat that killed a teenage girl goes on the record saying that before his own shooting death, his murder, Paul Murdoch may, in fact, have been a murderer himself. Hello and welcome to Banfield. The danger is still there, and then some. The desperation grows by the hour, but the numbers, they're finally looking up. And I say finally, because the Taliban took over Kabul a week ago Saturday, at which point, for millions of Afghans and their friends around the world, time essentially stopped. Officially now, the Pentagon has delivered more than 37,000 people from the Taliban's clutches. This after days and days of flying out far fewer people than the massive military cargo jets could hold. The government has pressed into service United and Delta and American Airlines, as well as others, to fly their planes across the world and bring the evacuees from where they are now, outside of Afghanistan, and take them to where they need to go, including the United States. Five sites in the United States are now receiving Afghans as of today, including military bases in Wisconsin, Virginia, Texas, and New Jersey, as well Dulles Airport near Washington. And the images that are coming in, well, they tell a story. Each one of those stories. Babies, moms, flying for days, running for their lives, with nothing but what they're carrying. Sometimes just the child, sometimes just a bag, sometimes nothing at all. So on the bottom, it says Inside Ashley's Digital Dunkirk, and there's a reason for that. If you've been watching this show for the last week, I have been alluding to what I've been hearing from the administration, what it doesn't jive with what I've been doing with my team. And let me give you the backstory. I went to Afghanistan back after 9/11, and I spent months there in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And you can't do anything in Afghanistan unless you have a fixer. A fixer is somebody you meet locally who knows the way things work and can help you get to places safely and can also translate. Officially, they can become translators, and I had someone just like that, a fixer and a translator. Tonight, I'm going to call him Jawad, but his name is not Jawad, and there's a reason for that. Jawad left me and NBC and went on to work for 20 years with the U.S. military. This was Tora Bora. I'm in the front there, looking pretty worse for wear after months and months. But this is where we parted with him, and it's where he pretty much parted with the press and moved on to work for people like this man. I know you recognize him. Jawad spent 20 years with the U.S. military, working with them in the most dangerous places, protecting them, to the point where he could be arm in arm with United States President George W. Bush. That, my friend, is what you call a high-level target for the Taliban. Jawad, my friend. Jawad was given citizenship, and he was told by us that we would protect him. The United States would protect him and his family. He came to the U.S. and was about to bring the family when the Taliban took over Kabul, and the family was trapped. His American wife, his American two little children, and then his extended family, his mom, his two sisters, teachers, both of them, college educated, and his brother-in-law. The Taliban paid them a visit, and Jawad heard about it afterwards. They broke into his mother's house, and they demanded to know where Jawad was, and they showed the picture of Jawad and President Bush. And then they proceeded to beat up his brother-in-law and warned them they'd be back. that they wanted Jawad. So they went to a safe house, and Jawad contacted me and all the other people with whom he worked and said, my son, who you're seeing, my daughter, my wife, my mom, 78, my sisters, my brother-in-law, they all need our help. I can't get them from the safe house to the airport gates because there's Taliban checkpoints everywhere and their lives are indeed in danger. So we, about a group of eight of us, got together for the first time, really, many of us. We didn't really know each other. We'd only met on email because we'd all worked with Jawad. He had our backs. He saved my life. He saved their lives. And it was time for us to save his family's life. And over the course of the last week, as I spoke with Jawad and went through the process of trying to get his family to the gates, pulling every single connection and link that we all had, it didn't work. Time and time again, they went to the gates. It didn't work. And then it came time to bring down the hammer and hopefully have a secret rescue operation, which happened on Saturday night. And I am happy to say all of them, the three American citizens and the four Afghans who were all in peril, were rescued and brought to that airport and flown out on a C-17. They are all safe and in Qatar tonight. It has been a hell of a journey for all of them, and it has been a hell of a time for Jawad, who has been desperate to rescue his family and hoped that the rest of us could help him. And I am so happy to introduce you to Jawad tonight. Hi. Feels weird to call you Jawad, but hi, how are you?
Hi, Ash. Thanks. Thanks for having me here. Thank you.
So let's start this way. I met you in Afghanistan. You took the butt end of a rifle for me at the Intercontinental Hotel when, you know, hopped up soldiers tried to give us trouble. And I wasn't the first. You worked with the United States military for the next 20 years, helping them through some of the worst and most dangerous places as a cultural liaison, as a translator. And then you found yourself in this circumstance. Take me back to last week, Jawad, and how you reached out to me and the others on the team, who everyone's about to meet. Tell me how it started.
Well, first of all, again, thanks for having me here for the show. So as soon as the Taliban took over Kabul, and after like 2 days, last week, I got a call. Actually, the next day when the incident took place, I got a call from my mom and my sister, and a group of armed Taliban militants broke into my mom's house in the vicinity of Kabul, and they were looking actually for me because of my employment background and previous work that I did for the United States government and also the United States Army, and they threatened my family to live, show where am I, you know, so about my location and about my previous background. So they tried to search the house, and also on the way back, you know, they slapped and also beat my brother-in-law. So it was a horrible situation that they went through. So when I talked to my mom, she was like kind of crying. She told me that this is all because of you, because you put us in danger. And so it is like unacceptable for actually. So it was like I kind of explaining the situation that, you know, went through and into my mind. So first, you know, I took a deep breath, and then I said I have to like do something. And then I was like,
"So let me jump in here, Jawad. We're losing your signal a little bit. I just want to jump in because we're not hearing everything you're saying. But I want you to take me to the first effort that your team, me, and all the other incredible military members and media members that our viewers are about to meet. We made some arrangements to try to get you through the gate, and you sent your cousin ahead to do a dry run through all of those things that our viewers have been seeing, the Taliban checkpoints. So tell me about what your cousin endured and what happened when your wife and kids and your extended family followed them that day.
So before sending my wife and my family to the gate, so, you know, there were like thousands of people crowded, you know, at the Kabul airport gates, you know, both the north gate, east gate, and everywhere. So it was really difficult for women, you know, also for kids, and then also for an elderly woman to make their way all the way to the gate. So instead, I sent my cousin to just go and check, see what's going on, and if there's any way that we can send my mom and my sisters and everybody to the gate. So as soon as he made his way to the gate, it was really difficult. So he just sat in the corner, and there was a Taliban, you know, so he was hitting, whipping everybody.
This is him.
In and around. Actually.
Jawad, this is him. This is his video. He's shooting it as the guy's about to come and whip him.
Yeah, so and then he whipped him on his back, so he was really badly injured. So and then he came back and told me that it's really difficult, you know, especially for women, and for kids to get to the gate. So again, so despite with all these, you know, difficulties, you know, I sent my mom and my sisters and my kids to the gate. So as soon as they spent like almost like 8 hours outside the gate, so it was really difficult for them. So at least they managed to get close to the gate, and they were like, as soon as my wife got close to the gate, she called me, and I was in the background. I was I heard like the Taliban was shooting like warning fires, and she was like, my wife said like my kids were just like a feet away from the Taliban, and she was screaming. I literally heard my kids were screaming, you know. And like a 5 years old kid, it was really difficult. It was like such a nightmare. My wife explained that it was really difficult for me. So I said, okay, just leave.
Jawad, do me a favor and tell me now, like, so they left. They left that terrible situation at the gates, not getting through, back to the safe house. Walk me through Saturday night. I'm just understanding we can't tell our viewers everything about this operation because there are other Afghans who still need to be rescued. But walk me through the directions they were given by high-level U.S. Armed Forces members to wait for the phone call, pack one small backpack, and tell me, you know, briefly, what happened to them that night that they actually were rescued?
Yeah, so my wife got a phone call from an unknown number, and she was instructed to just get ready and have a backpack, everybody, around like, and it was early in the morning, and told them to just show up on a specific location within the Kabul vicinity. So, and they did it. So all seven went there and drove at the dawn. It was like around, it was dawn. So once they got to that location, then like after exact specific time, you know, that they were giving to my wife, there was a vehicle showed up, and then they rescued my wife along with other 25 people. So after like a few minutes, they rushed in, you know, to Kabul airport gate, and then they were rescued by, you know, the rescue team.
So the reason why the faces are so blurred still is that there is still such a risk that, you know, today there are news reports saying that the Taliban has passed down its first death sentence for the brother of a translator. So you can imagine the existing danger for any family members, you know, that exist for anybody, let alone distant family members for Jawad and his family. So we're, you know, keeping the adults' faces digitized. But Jawad, I can't even tell you just the tears of joy that I shed on Saturday night hearing that that operation was underway and worked, and that all of them, not just the American part of your family, but that all of them were saved. I'm going to take a quick break, Jawad, but when we come back, you're going to meet everybody. You're going to meet the team. You're going to meet the team that got together, this Digital Dunkirk group, to pull every single favor we have ever compiled to help Jawad's family get out. What's next? And in the meantime, if you want to help the GoFundMe for Jawad and his family, you can go to GoFundMe and just search Jawad-Rescue or search my name and you'll find it. Back right after this. Welcome back. Tonight we are telling an amazing story that honestly, I really couldn't tell you fully before, and I still really can't completely tell you tonight. The flight to freedom of an Afghan family who I and many others got to know through the indispensable work of their father, their husband, their brother, their son, who worked as a translator and as a fixer for the United States media, and more importantly, 2 decades for the United States military. That man, my friend, whom we are calling Jawad, is still with us tonight, telling his story of how we got this harrowing escape of his family figured out. And tonight I am so pleased to introduce you to three other members of our little digital Dunkirk family, a family I didn't know until recently, but now will forever always love. John Sematowski is a retired U.S. Army colonel who served in Afghanistan as a judge advocate general, JAG. He trained Afghan judges and lawyers, and of course he met Jawad. Mike Orloff is a retired Army major who served in Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne, and Jawad was, of course, his interpreter. And the lovely and talented Amanda Fox is a communications strategist and force to be reckoned with. She's also a former NBC News producer. She, too, met Jawad. Her path, my path, Jawad's path. We all crossed in Afghanistan back in 2001 through 2020. To the three of you, hurrah. Congratulations. You did it. I also want to mention, goes without saying, there are some faces that you will not see tonight. Some people who are still working tirelessly on our team to continue rescuing others who think it better perhaps not to make a public face as they continue their remarkable work. Okay, Colonel Sematowski, I call you John, but for these purposes, Colonel, this was really quite an incredible operation, an amazing team, and such an emotional effort for all of us. Give me your feelings, just knowing what you learned on Saturday night.
You know, thinking about it, Ashley, it's really a remarkable group of people that had bonded over a remarkable man, Jawad, and came together to accomplish a remarkable feat.
Yeah. Okay. Major Mike Orloff, we didn't know each other even by face until, gosh, what is it? I think last night we finally had our first Zoom and met each other by face. It's been this incredible email. Digital Dunkirk, the term is true. Give me your thoughts and feelings about this effort that we've just all come through together for Jawad and his family.
Thanks, Ashley. First off, thanks for having me here tonight to share, you know, our story. You're lucky if you meet a few dynamic folks in your life, and Jawad was just one of them. You know, he was there when, you know, the times were tough for all of us, you know, and especially when we're in a new place, you know, potentially, you know, hostile environment. And you know, you having someone that's personal, that understands the environment, that loves our country, makes it easy to create those bonds, those lifelong bonds. And I look at the Digital Dunkirk team, and he attracts such talent and dynamic folks. So I'm just happy to be a part of it. I couldn't do my job. I had 150 highly talented soldiers underneath me from the 82nd, and we brought everybody back. So again, I couldn't do it without him. He is very versatile. Not only he's able to do the immigration or the working with the judges, but he's also tactical and is comfortable in all shoes. So Jawad, my hat's off to you, and always great seeing you again, buddy.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
So, listen, you know, Mike, you undersell it when you say what an amazing team. This team had the highest level. I mean, a couple of generals and colonels and majors and like people I was calling sir, and I'm not in the military. Amanda, you and I met 2001. I think it was in Peshawar in the craziest of places. And here we are 20 years later meeting again over this amazing feat. You know, the highest level United States military forces were involved in all of this and the tactical efforts that it took. I'd love to hear your perspective.
First of all, like everyone said, I owe Jawad everything. I was in, when you're in such a place and you're so incredibly vulnerable and you don't know the environment well, a fixer is everything. And so as far as I'm concerned, he protected me. And when someone does that for you, you owe them forever. And I would do anything for him. And it's an honor to be able to do something for him. The situation was horrific, but of course I would step up. And as I know everyone that was involved feels the same way. And to be among these incredible people and watching everybody around the clock working so hard was a very moving, incredible thing, but not surprising if you know Jawad. And the other thought is that you talked about the strings we all pulled. I did. Everybody did. One of the things that was very moving to me is the phone calls that I made to high-ranking people in the military, in the Navy, that don't know Jawad, who dropped everything to help us. Total strangers to him, who made this their mission, too, for several days. Constant texts throughout the night, waking up in the morning. I had a thought in the middle of the night, and I had to call you. I have an idea. Total strangers to make this happen. And then the thought that Jawad, again, to his credit entirely, has these connections and these people. And there are a lot of Jawads out there who don't. And that's what pains me so much. We got seven people out through tremendous effort. And tremendous effort, and it almost didn't work. And there are others. There are so many others. So that still pains me tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a couple of false starts. We were all in contact every single night. And, you know, we would all cross our fingers and stay up until all hours of the morning texting with Jawad to say, did it work? Did it work? Did it work? Only to find, no, they didn't make it to the gate, or they were, you know, some of them were turned away and they're not leaving without each other, which was, you know, so heartbreaking just to think of this human chain holding their hands together so tightly. Jawad, I know you're listening to everybody talking about how it's testament to you that you have these enduring friendships that have lasted 20 years. It's not the first time we've talked to you in 20 years. We've maintained a long friendship and stayed in touch with you for a good reason. Tell us how they are. I know it's not a good environment where they are right now. They're in a hangar with 3,000 people, and they are in, you know, transit in Qatar, waiting for their next dispatch and waiting for their next flight, hopefully to the United States. But how are they doing? How's your wife? How are your kids?
Well, I mean, they're mentally and physically, they're relieved right now because, you know, they made it safe out of, you know, Kabul City to the airport, and then they flew to Qatar. So the last time, like an hour ago, when I was still like that, you know, and Qatar is still like this early in the morning, but my wife, I was texting, you know, back and forth with her, and she's really happy, you know. It's a little bit hot out there, you know, not only for my wife, but there are like thousands of more other, you know, people, including children, you know, elderly women out there. So, and she's doing good, and she's waiting, you know, for end processing immigration paperwork. And as soon as, you know, that's get done, and I think they will head to the land of freedom here to the United States.
Hopefully. Yeah, and I'm, you know, we're showing the pictures, and clearly the reason, if you're just joining us, that they are all digitized is that there is a continuing threat. Clearly, except for that, these are long ago pictures of your little ones, so they look different now. But man, are they cute! The threat is high when you are arm in arm with the President of the United States, and the reason you're arm in arm with the President of the United States is because you gave so much to all of us on this team and to the United States. So, on behalf of, you know, folks in the U.S. here, and of course folks on this team, we can't thank you enough for what you did for us, and we are so glad that we could get together and do this one small favor and get your family to safety. And I just want to let our audience know that this is going to be hard. They're arriving here with a small backpack each. They're leaving their entire lives behind. And so if you want to help them, we got a GoFundMe set up for Jawad and his family. It's easy to find. You just go to GoFundMe, and the page is Jawad-Rescue. Jawad Rescue. If you search Ashley Banfield, if you search Jawad Rescue, you're going to find the GoFundMe page, and I encourage you to help us even further help this patriot, who we can't show you, but I love you.
Yes,
God, I'm so glad to see your family.
Yes,
I can't wait to see them in person when they get here.
Yeah, so before we go, so I just want to add a little bit, you know, and I'm honored, you know, the profound sacrifice of the United States government that they have made in Afghanistan for the past 20 years. It's freedom, you know, not for everybody, like for men, women, and girls. And I also salute to every American military personnel who have served in Afghanistan, you know, I know many of them on multiple tours. Also, especially, you know, I'll thank the unit that helped my family and made their way and did everything possible, provided a safe passage to my family to Kabul Airport. So I'm really, you know, proud of those elite military forces.
Well, testament to you, our friend Jawad, not his real name. And I look forward to talking to you off air, my friend. Again, if you want to help Jawad and his family as they resettle here, great patriot on that screen right there. Jawad-rescue at the GoFundMe site. Thank you, Jawad. And by the way, we'll pop up the other faces as well so I can say goodbye to you proper. That on the left there is Colonel John Simutowski. In the middle, Major Mike Orloff. And on the right, Amanda Fox. Folks, thank you for this. God bless, and I hope we can all raise a glass together. Wow. It's my new family, and I am thrilled to meet them. So when we come back, I'm going to switch gears. There is that story we've been telling you all summer, the Murdaugh case. Would you believe there is more bloodshed in this case? Before the double murder of Alex Murdaugh and his mother, the wealthy, powerful family in South Carolina, before the fatal boat accident involving him that killed Mallory Beach, and before a teenager was beaten and left for dead in a roadside, a surviving passenger on board the boat says that Alex Murdaugh had blood on his hands from the very beginning. We'll solve that mystery for you in a moment. The Murdaugh family saga. Rich and powerful low country folks in South Carolina. A mother and her son gunned down in cold blood. And it was their murders that unearthed quite a story, starting with a fatal boat accident, one that killed a young woman named Mallory Beach. And now, according to a surviving passenger on board the boat that fateful night, Paul Murdaugh may have killed before. A housekeeper allegedly pushed down the steps. But that's not all. Allegations also, a teenage boy beaten and left for dead in the middle of a road. These are pretty strong allegations, none of them proven, but we have a lot to unpack here with reporter Andrew Davis with WSAV Television, attorney Mark O'Mara, and former prosecutor and attorney Susan Filan. Welcome to you all. Andrew, I'm going to begin with you with these extraordinary accusations that come from one of the boat passengers, Connor Cook, in a deposition where he's not just alleging that Paul Murdaugh may have killed before, he's also alleging that the police, two different agencies, conspired to cover it up and instead point the finger at him, Connor Cook. Tell me a little bit about how this is all starting to come out in depositions.
Yeah, Connor Cook's deposition is based on a lawsuit that he's filed with the idea that he was trying to be framed by the Murdaugh family, as well as law enforcement, to be the driver of the boat that night. So his deposition has come out. In response to that, they're saying the deposition proves, however, that Connor didn't tell them initially that Paul was the actual driver. And Connor comes back and says and said he was scared, that he was told to keep his mouth shut by Alex Murdaugh, but to say, you'll be taken care of, don't worry about it. At the same time, he felt like everybody was instead pointing the fingers directly at him, that investigators specifically were asking him questions. He wasn't sure which way he should go with it. Only after the fact did he admit that Paul was the driver. Several of the other people on that boat did not admit immediately that Paul was the driver as well, which comes back to the fact that Alex Murdaugh has been connected to not just the scene, but back in the hospital as well, where he potentially strong-armed people into making sure they would stay quiet to keep his son protected. And he talked about those murders in the past or the possible situations in the past. There's a lot more to unravel here, but it all really started with Mallory Beach's death, with the drunk driving accusations that were there. And Paul Murdaugh's lawyers have already said they would try to get the whole blood alcohol thrown out, even though he was potentially three times the legal limit when he ended up crashing. It's a very complicated situation with Anthony Cook and Connor Cook. Anthony was Mallory Beach's boyfriend. Mallory was the one who died in that boat crash. Connor was the one who claims he was trying to be framed for the situation to save Paul's face.
So what's amazing, and again, affidavits are a funny thing. You can file an affidavit and you can say things in an affidavit, and you can't libel a dead man. And you can't always libel anybody in an affidavit either. Let me just read exactly what Connor Cook said in the affidavit connected to this lawsuit about, you know, the fear that two law enforcement agencies were conspiring to frame him. He said, Alex Murdaugh told me, and I'm going to quote the deposition here, that everything was going to be all right. This is in the hospital while he's getting his jaw fixed. And that I just needed to keep my mouth shut and tell them I didn't know who was driving and that he's got me. It went on to say that if he, when he was asked if there were any other incidents he knew about with this family, he said, well, one said that Paul had pushed his housemaid down the stairs and she died and nothing ever happened. Again, this is from the deposition. And then regarding the second incident and another one, he quotes, there was something that Paul was supposedly involved with a guy, got found beat up in the middle of the road, and that they got out of. So he's alleging that there are two of these incidents. Can I ask real quickly what, Andrew Davis, has been the response of the police agencies, the two agencies who are being accused in this lawsuit, that they're conspiring on behalf of the Murdaugh family to shift the focus away from their son, Paul, and onto Connor Cook instead? What's their response to these allegations?
Well, they've denied everything that's come up. In fact, in that deposition, part of why the Connor Cook deposition came up is they're using it against Connor Cook's situation and saying, he didn't tell us the truth from the beginning, so you can't say that we didn't do the right thing, that we didn't do everything that we could to try to solve this case. Even though they took blood, they took situations where they were trying to get Connor Cook's blood alcohol level from the scene, but they didn't ask for Paul Murdaugh's. So there's a question there on what they did. They've completely denied it. They want the entire case thrown out right now. And then you add in this Gloria Satterfield, who is the housekeeper who died, who suddenly ended up with $500,000, and that about 117 of that went to the lawyers. And then the Stephen Smith case, which is the other one you're speaking of, the boy found in the street, and he had defensive wounds on his hands, and there's still questions. That's been hanging out there for years. But law enforcement, you know, even though the Murdaugh name was put in 40 times inside that Stephen Smith investigation, they've never gone really back to dig deeper into that case until the murders happen, and suddenly they've reopened this case, but they won't say why they've reopened this case either. So are the Murdaughs connected? Are they not connected? And exactly how far did some of these investigators go who were deeply involved with the Murdaugh family through the solicitor's office to protect Alex Murdaugh and probably Paul Murdaugh at the same time?
I mean, it is a very complicated story, but I mean, no matter how you slice it, it is tragic to think of a mother and son being gunned down in cold blood on their ranch, and a brother and a father being left behind. When we come back after the break, I'm going to put it to our two attorneys. What do you do with all of this when the linchpin in the case is dead and there's a murder investigation about him? What exactly can happen here? What exactly should happen? That's coming up after the break. Back now with reporter Andrew Davis, attorney Mark O'Mara, and former prosecutor Susan Filan. Mark O'Mara, I'll begin with you. This is complicated, make no mistake, but there are some serious accusations against two law enforcement agencies, and they are pushing back. Where will this go?
Well, what's interesting is the one law enforcement agency that's pushing back is sort of saying this: wait a minute, we did investigate back then, and you didn't tell us information that, had you told us, we could have instilled that into our investigation. And what's interesting is we're sort of going to come to see what happens now, because had that information been made available to them, law enforcement back then, maybe something would have been done differently. And here's the other thing. If he had actually told them the information back then and they covered it up, then it's sort of documenting the conspiracy. But they're sort of going to get a bit of a pass when it's Cook who didn't give them the information that would have allowed them to go forward in the investigation. There's just a lot here, a lot of layers to this onion that's going to have to be unraveled. We just need to do it sort of slowly and follow the evidence, follow the affidavits, and see where the litigation takes us. But there's a lot more to see here.
Yeah. And Susan, the interesting thing is when Connor Cook was in the back of the cruiser after this horrible accident that killed Mallory Beach, there's audio from a dash cam where he is visibly upset when he sees Paul Murdaugh crossing in front of the car, and from the back seat starts throwing the epithets, and the police officer in the front seat said, what's the problem? And he alludes to that's the guy. And then when asked, is he the one who's driving? All he can say is, at last I saw, because when Connor was thrown from the boat, he was facing backwards, holding Mallory, his girlfriend. So he said, at last I saw, that was the guy driving. And that seems to me to be a contemporaneous admission, that's the driver. But now that police officer has been fired, and the second officer that kind of got the corroboration that night, he's got a connection to the Murdaugh. So again, messy, messy, confusing, confusing. But ultimately, this is a deposition in a civil case. And it came just weeks after the murders. Is it strong given the timing, given the fact that it wasn't within the last year and a half after the boat accident?
As you said, it's very murky and very confusing. And I think you just alluded to the key here. This is a deposition in a civil case, which means that it's the estate of the decedent trying to find who she can pin as liable for this accidental death, or whatever, however they're going to characterize it, so that she gets a payout. Now, what's Connor Cook's motivation for coming forward now and saying, you know, I was framed? Is it a little bit of pot, kettle black? You know, the police messed this up, but I misled them. And is that enough to absolve the police if they have, in fact, colluded in any way? No, it isn't. It isn't enough for them to say, well, we got thrown off because you didn't tell us the truth, if there were other reasons why they got thrown off, such as they were paid to get thrown off. But again, bottom line, why is Connor Cook testifying this way now? And as you asked before, what result? What can possibly come of this? I personally think it sounds a little fishy and a little weak. Not that it isn't necessarily true, but it's not enough to do anything with. And as your other guest said, you know, we have to follow the unraveling of this onion. We do. But again, what result? The civil case is about money at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's what I always say. Follow the money. Mark O'Mara, real quickly, you know, when you say in an affidavit, oh, I heard he killed, the housemaid, pushed her down the steps and nothing happened. And oh, and I heard he had something to do with that young man in the road who was found dead as well. That's mysterious. You can't libel a dead guy. But is there any danger for him saying that if it's not true and it's rumor?
Well, possibly. But I think more importantly, what's happening here is whether it's the legal team, Cook and the legal team, what they're trying to do, I think, is to cause a law enforcement agency, and now SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, is now doing this. I think that what they want them to do is a full investigation into all of this. And look, if Cook and his testimony did nothing else but open up the can of worms so that SLED looks into the housemaid or the housekeeper's death, or Mr. Smith's death, which was coincidentally not looked into and not investigated very well from what we can tell, and now look into the question of whether or not Alex Murdaugh had something to do with short-circuiting or redirecting the investigation. I think that is what we need to be looking at, and those are the onion leaves that I think are going to be unraveled here, because if SLED, an agency not beholden to the Murdaugh dynasty or family, really looks into this and starts doing their investigations, then over time we may actually get some answers to questions that have been around for these families of lost loved ones for years.
I am flat out of time, but, you know, you all have to come back because I don't think this is going away. It just gets stranger and stranger. Thank you to all three of you, Andrew, Mark, and Susan. See you again soon. When we come back, how could Andrew Cuomo's approval rating possibly get any lower? How about this? If you abandon your dog, that's how your approval rating gets lower. But is this just a story? Is this piling on, or is there any truth to it? We're going to examine this story in a moment. There is a story that's getting a lot of pickup, and it comes at a time when Andrew Cuomo's press couldn't get any worse. It involves Cuomo leaving the governor's mansion in Albany and allegedly leaving behind not a suitcase, not some books or stuff, but his dog. His dog named Captain. There is pushback from the governor's team saying this is just basically a vacation. It was a dog sitter. He didn't leave him behind for good. But others are saying he may have. Here to shed some light on all of this is News Nation correspondent Tom Negevin in Manhattan. Listen, it could be pylon. It could be true. What are you finding out?
You know what? Sounds like a combination of the two, Ashley, and I take you for a dog lover as well. Folks here in New York absolutely incensed by what they're hearing about Captain Cuomo and the situation at the executive mansion in Albany. This is a story that broke in the Albany Times-Union over the weekend. The paper citing a couple of sources close to the administration, state police sources, who said that the movers came and went, took most of Andrew Cuomo's stuff, pretty much all of it, to his sister's place in Westchester, where he'd be staying for a bit, left the dog behind, saying that the governor had left and left the dog. His office, his spokesperson vehemently saying that is not the case. This is a headline blown entirely out of proportion. He's been working. The dog's been with the staff of the executive mansion in Albany and would leave tonight, as Captain did with Andrew Cuomo as he vacated the governor's mansion for the final time. But people are still pretty upset about this and not believing, after multiple scandals and these allegations, this report from the state AG, Ashley, involving allegations from 11 women. They wonder if they're getting the entire story about the dog.
So this business about, and I've only have a minute left, but the business about the governor asking staffers prior to all this, will you take Captain? And some of the staffers saying, no, you know, the dog nips a bit. Makes me think two things. Oh, then he clearly wanted to get rid of the dog. Or he didn't bring the dog to, say, his sister's house because maybe there's kids there and she doesn't want them to get nipped. I mean, there seems to be an answer for all the accusations, but everybody seems to be making a lot of sport of this.
Right, and also often a grain of truth, Ashley, and that seems to be it right there that you've hit upon. The governor's spokesperson saying, look, he was going to go on a vacation once he leaves office tonight. Vacation starts tomorrow. He just wanted a staffer to take the dog for a little bit. And someone has tried to take Captain for a while, but that nipping issue you reference, this dog has bitten a few people in the past, so taking care of the animal for him is a bit difficult. A lot of people, though, on social media and elsewhere, pretty outraged about this, volunteering to take Captain off Andrew Cuomo's hands tonight.
Tom Negevin doing the work for us in Manhattan. I know you're going to get to the bottom of it, my friend. Thank you for this.
Sure.
Tom reporting live for us. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, but not before I remind you, if you wanted to give to the GoFundMe account for Jawad, my translator, and his family arriving here with nothing but a backpack, it is GoFundMe. It's Jawad-Rescue.